Welcome to the True Blue LA podcast. I'm Jacob Birch. With me is movie major league super fan Eric Steven.
It's the greatest baseball movie there is. It's my favorite sports movie. I will say the only movie that ranks up there with it is the Naked Gun, only for the baseball scenes. So, but that's that's obviously stretching it out a little bit. But I will say the poster, the tagline on the poster for Major League is, when these three oddballs try to play baseball, the result is totally screwball.
Which is a little weird, right? There's more than three.
Right. I should point out that the poster itself has the three main stars of the movie, star-wise. And the three main characters baseball-wise in the movie, it's... Tom Berenger as Jake Taylor, Charlie
Bob
Sheen.
Uecker as
no, but it, yeah, yeah. It doesn't he's and then Wesley Snipes as Willie Mays Hayes. So yeah, it's a solid movie. So this was your idea. We'll get into it, but
are going to make a Dodger, an all time Dodger team as an ode to the movie Major League, and we'll explain what that means. All that after this. So I got the idea for this episode because you and I, before the virus had kind of started, done a Dodgers decade team. Before we really needed filler material, we still did it. And I'm like, well, lists are great. They're fun to come up with. People tend to like arguing about them, thinking about that. So we could do a worst of the decade list. But then I thought, one, that's kind of hard because how do you qualify... minimum appearances, how bad you have to be,
and it's also mean.
Yeah, it's also mean, and it's just disparaging. But I still kind of wanted to do this because there's so many kind of bad players or who had a bad time with the Dodgers that are just sort of delightful stories, and we never really got to lift them up because they're not going to come up on any best lists. So it took some thinking. But I just figured out what I wanted to do was similar to the movie Major League. I wanted a bunch of ragtag misfits that no one would actually want on their team. But when you put them together and they have a good enough story and you get the right prescription glasses, all of a sudden they can maybe win a pennant.
Yeah. And so in the movie itself, the backstory is, the Indians owner died and the team gets left to his wife, I think.
You're the expert, but yes.
Rachel Phelps is the new sort of owner. I believe she's billed as a former showgirl in the as her character, but she's trying to tank the Indians in the movie so she can break the lease in Cleveland and move to a new stadium, which is sort of already in negotiations in Miami Beach, and it's more lucrative for the franchise, more specifically for her. She gets to be part of some country club, I forget. But I love that this is how they sort of do it. I mean, look, it's a movie. I'm not expecting it. I'm not going to break it down like I did Moneyball, where they sort of insisted that you have to fly somewhere to make a trade so you could do it in person. I'm not at that level here, but she just sort of meeting with her sort of front office, the general manager, the sort of the baseball operations department, even though they didn't really name it that back then. She just hands them in a boardroom, pieces of paper and says, here's our, who we're inviting to camp this year. And I was watching this scene the other day, and I sort of transcribed it. It's very quick, but the first guy goes, I've never heard of half these guys, and the ones I do know are way past their prime. And then the general manager, who sort of gets a little bit of run later in the movie, he has some lines, but he says, most of these guys never had a prime, kind of under his breath. And then my favorite is the one sort of other guy, he goes, this guy here is dead. And then Rachel Phelps goes, cross him off then. So, like, that's the spirit of the movie. She's the evil sort of owner, and they rally behind her and all that kind of stuff.
So our storyline is the McCourts have retaken over the Dodgers, and they've hired two podcast hosts to make the roster. But we have to go over two lists that you generated on Baseball Reference. These are the only players we can pick from. Also, we have a time machine, because otherwise our list is very, very small. So we can pick any Dodger. I guess you came up with the list, so I'll let you explain the criteria.
Yeah, so I think you sort of came up with this loose criteria, and you had, before we had like gone over the like the entire like population of this, you had some examples. I think you were talking about, oh yeah, this is pretty good. I think you were the one who came up with one WAR. We're using the Baseball Reference version just because of the play index, and one total WAR or less with the Dodgers. So if I looked on the play index, and if you make it a minimum of 200 plate appearances, there's 238 players. These are non-pitchers, by the way. I sort of got them out of there. So 238 players with at least 200 plate appearances with the Dodgers, and no more than one total win above replacement. For pitchers, I lowered the minimum to 50 innings pitched just to get a better sort of sample, and also it gives us a chance to see some relievers in there too, because maybe with a short time. But there's 184 pitchers with no more than one WAR with the Dodgers with 50 innings pitched. So that's our population, and we're going to draft a team from that list.
So and as soon as you gave me the list, it became pretty clear, like, oh, this is it. This is the list we're using.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and I want to point out too, like, I made this note, like, and I I think if we were doing this like in the fictional world of Major League, like Jake Taylor, I don't think he would qualify, not because he was like washed up at the time, he's been out of the league, he was in the Mexican League for a while, and like he fit the movie's purposes perfectly and would probably fit nicely on our team, but his like backstory, he was a former multiple-time All-Star, I believe, in Boston, and I would be shocked as a catcher like that valuable who, if he had no more than one WAR, like he had to have had. Like,
but
some good
I think
years
it ends
there.
Up working. I have some examples that I think actually fit the Jake Taylor mold perfectly. In that, as long as their time with the Dodgers was near the end of their career, they're putting up one WAR with the Dodgers or less.
So okay. I didn't think of it that way. That's absolutely right. So if we're looking at Baseball Reference through the 1989 season with the Indians, Jake Taylor like would have been obviously team leader, but his stats are probably meh, and probably like, you know, arm was a little bit shot.
Yeah,
probably
is getting a little creative license here, but I think it's going to work out.
He's probably right at like 0.8 WAR.
Yeah,
for that season. I mean, you're right. That's exactly right. Good thought. Yeah.
So to give an example, I'm going to start. I kind of want to start with hitters.
Oh. Before we do it, let's outline the team. We did a similar draft with the 2010s draft. We're just keeping it at 15 players, and it's broken down. Eight starting position players, and I think we're going to be pretty loose with the outfield. We're not necessarily confining it to one left fielder, one center fielder, one right fielder. And then one utility player can be anything. I like, ideally, it's probably someone who plays multiple positions, but honestly, it's just an extra offensive player. Could be a pinch hitter. Four starting pitchers and two relief pitchers, and I imagine, just given some of the players or pitchers I had seen on the list, that we're going to be pretty liberal here. Like if a player did both,
I have to do a little cheating here.
Yeah, no, so it's totally fine. And like, and plus, you mentioned this, we're not going to do it two teams with a draft. We're going to go position by position and then try to come to a consensus on each position.
And if not, we're going to open it up to Twitter and the listeners, and you can tell us who made the stronger case for their player.
I like it.
And to start things off, I want to start, like I said, kind of with batters for a particular reason, because I have a lot of very fun pitchers. But I want to start with our closer, because I think we can give good example of what we're talking about when we have a player that would go in here by the only current Dodger I have on my list. Joe Kelly, I think, is the perfect example of a player that goes on this list.
Okay, so I will say this. I I don't disagree with you, and I don't really want to fight on this one. I listed six players or six relief pitchers on here, and didn't include Joe Kelly. But honestly, like I was only like, you know, two of them at most. You know, I was just trying to fill in like who I thought. So I am okay with Joe Kelly.
In the right, if everything goes right, Joe Kelly can anchor our bullpen as we try to win a pennant.
Yeah.
Story-wise, we've been over it in a long time. He is a colorful and delightful character with plenty of stories to go behind him. And he fits perfectly in the Charlie Sheen role of Wild Thing. And that wears the glasses, is Wild Thing.
He literally broke a window in his house pitching against the Mets. So it's perfect. You're right.
Okay.
And now I won't say who one of my or two of my choices are because I think I'll have a better way to explain it later after we pick some more players.
That's totally fine. Yeah, I just wanted to get Joe Kelly out of the way as a perfect modern example.
Okay.
I guess the one other thing I'll say is my list definitely slants towards players I'm familiar with, so that's sort of totally mid-90s and onward, with three or four extreme exceptions to that, and we'll get there in a bit. Okay.
Can we go catcher next?
I have catcher. That's what I was going to do. I'll let you start.
Okay, so this list is kind of amazing. Well, for one, I will just say that if you look at the list of players who are, you know, with one or fewer WAR, the top three players in games played are all catchers. The top two in hits are catchers, and as well as the number four player is. But looking at this list, there's only one name that you have to have, and it's Bill Bergen, who is like the worst hitter in Major League history. And the reason I want him on the team is because he, I just want to see why. Like, we have Jeff Mathis now, right, who's a terrible hitter, but, like, every team loves. They all rave about him. I want to experience that with Bill Bergen and figure out why everyone loved him. His time with the Dodgers, eight seasons. Actually, he might have missed a season or two in there or got injured, but total of 2,340 plate appearances, negative 5.8 WAR.
OPS
372, 162, 184, 187. Like that has to happen. So but I'm willing to listen to arguments for someone else. But Bill Bergen is like the one guy.
I think I'm going to relent to you. I have a good backup option from my era. Yes. Charles Johnson, and I'm going the flip side of. The two main criteria I was looking for is one, for whatever reason, his time with the Dodgers just didn't produce one WAR, but I actually think they would be good and would be good on later. Charles Johnson fits this perfectly. And I think storyline-wise, the other criteria is associated with the Piazza trade, so sort of unfairly viewed perhaps in some Dodger fans' eyes, and also the majority of his career spent in Colorado and in Florida, kind of an afterthought a lot of times, so people forget just how really good he was.
He is also has a sort of a connection that isn't with his time with the Dodgers, because he was like the piece that would have helped in 2004 when they traded Paul LaDuca in the trade to get Brad Penny and Hsiao Choi. That was obviously a much maligned trade at the time. It was actually a fine baseball trade. Like, the Dodgers absolutely needed an ace. Brad Penny got hurt. They didn't have good enough pitching. They couldn't land Randy Johnson. They got him. He got hurt like two starts in, so like it just didn't work. But the Dodgers absolutely, Paul DePodesta failed to plug the catching hole. They used Brent Maine a lot down the stretch, and the catchers were terrible. And that really hurt them, and in the playoffs too, I think. But they had a deal worked out for Charles Johnson, and like I think DePodesta assumed that that was just going to happen and like it would help fill the gap, and it would have. But then Johnson had a no trade clause, and he said, nope, I'm going to stay in Colorado. So like you have to like get your ducks in a row before you do a trade like that. So that's a little other like what if type of a thing.
Also has a connection to a player that'll come up. I have to imagine on your list. Mine is definitely on my list, and I'll be making it stronger.
I can't think of who it is, obviously, but like I'm excited.
We'll talk about it. I like your reasoning. Well, I think I'll let you win, but I like my backup pick.
Yeah.
All right. First base.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So here's my case for the Jake Taylor of the group. First mm-hmm. baseman, Hall of Famer, High Pockets Kelly.
Oh man. Okay.
So I'm pulling up. Seeing if I can find, I had some notes on him. Giants manager John McGraw called him, trying to find the exact quote. There we go. John McGraw said there was no player he preferred to have in the bat in a big situation, and White Hoyt considered him dangerous in clutch situations. Two, his name is High Pockets, his nickname, obviously. Ended his career with the Dodgers in a trade. It was acquired by the Dodgers in a trade for a player I will be referring to later in the podcast. So I have that connection, this sort of trade connection. And also kind of was voted into the Hall of Fame on the Veterans Committee, kind of under some criticism of that it was mostly just his former teammates were on the Veterans Committee and they elected him in. And this is his chance to prove them all wrong and on the team he ended his career with.
Okay, so now this is like I'm not disagreeing with your choice. I forgot that this is hilarious. Okay, so the search thing on Baseball Reference, it's 238. So and there's only 200 per page. And when I did a sort, he comes up on the second page. I'm like wondering why am I not seeing him, right? and then actually there's a couple of other guys in here. I'm like, oh, like when I get to the second page, but like. Okay, that's pretty solid. Like, I'll say this. My choice for first base. Oh, man, there's a choice on the second page. It's awesome. my choice for first base was Franklin Stubbs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be an 88 Dodgers apologist here, but, like, it's going to come up a lot. And but my case for Stubbs is... On this list, he of all the Dodgers who have had fewer, you know, one WAR or fewer, Stubbs has the most home runs by 16. He has 59 home runs. He was, a starter partially in the playoffs. A starter, part-time regular on the 88 World Series team. So I'm partial to that. I'm not opposed to High Pockets Kelly. I have a feeling like this might be one where we put it up to a vote.
But I think
let's just I'm just gonna note for now, like we can come back to it because like okay. I'm sure this will get to a point where we might do some
and it may depend on the rest of the makeup of our team because I think he's a veteran leadership clutch hitter.
He played enough outfield to like qualify, so like that's a
and we're gonna get there when we get the second. He did play a season where he filled in at second, and so this was an area I was considering
with High Pockets or Stubbs.
High Pockets.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I was smoking for my
That's totally fine
because so, let me tell you, outfield is crowded on this list.
Wait, but did he play? Man, outfield is crowded, but it also so I think you have to play second base with the Dodgers. Like, if a we're going to use a guy to position, I think he had to play it with the Dodgers. We could go back and forth if like
sure. I'm looking it up. I'm sure he mostly played first for the Dodgers, but I do want to double check.
High Pockets did play one game in center field, so hey, yeah. I don't. Like looking at this, like second base, I have like the name I was thinking of, and again, this was before I went onto that second page, so like maybe there's one funnier one on there. But like my choice for second base is Bobby Valentine.
Okay,
and part of it is like I just want to sort of acknowledge that everyone talks about the 1968 draft by the Dodgers is probably the best draft ever by a single team. They drafted like so many players a year. Bobby Valentine was their first round pick. Like, he was their number one guy. So, like, that's a thing. He didn't really do that much with the Dodgers. That's why he's on this list. But, like, obviously went on to be much more famous after his playing days, managing, announcing, all that kind of stuff. So, like, there, he's a character for sure. I'm assuming he comes with the disguise kit. So, like, the team will have that. So, like, that's something on the plus side. But, like, again, I just looking at this list, this is probably the weakest position.
Oh, no, it was second was the hardest for me to fill. Yeah, so I was basically go. I had a few sort of like loose names, but Bobby V is way better than that. So I'm deferring to you for sure.
Okay, so just to say this now, the other, since I went on the second, I'm gonna open up two different tabs now, so I don't have to keep toggling back and forth. But the other name that came up on this was Alex Guerrero.
Sure.
Which, like, he had
his,
like,
surged his career in Japan.
A brief moment of like hotness, and then you know, all the sort of. You know what? He never played second with the Dodgers.
Oh, that's right.
I forgot about that. So he's out. All right. But also, like, he'd be disqualified anyway because you have to. You're like, Miguel Olivo was crazy when he bit his ear, but like, he was making people so mad with just boneheadedness in the field that he made a guy bite his ear. So like that's not a guy on this team. So like he's like an early. He'd have to have a redemption arc. Like, this would be early, like, this was, he'd be, like, stealing Joe Boo's rum early, and then at the end of the year, like, he'd be best friends with Joe Boo and all that stuff, but who knows, yeah.
So, next up is shortstop, and I think I'm going to defer to you here as well. Trust me, once we get the outfield, I'm golden, but I was having a hard time finding a great name, and I figured there was probably one from your era. I'm now looking, and I have an idea as well, but I'm going to let you go.
Okay, so we have this. I have three candidates who I would all go to war for. Like if it's any of them, I'd be like totally fine.
So
with.
How about this? I will pick for you. You make your case for the three, and I'll pick the winner.
Okay, so one. Don Zimmer's nickname is the Gerbil. He has the second most home runs of anyone on this list at 43.
I will let you know I had Don Zimmer as my third baseman up until an hour of last of research, and then I did switch. So I can hear that.
He played a lot of positions. He played shortstop the most with the Dodgers, so like that's him. He also had like played a lot. Like, he has his he's ninth on plate appearances, most plate appearances. So like, look, he had literally zero war, so like, he was replacement level. But I think there's something to be said, especially on this type of a team, for a guy who just hangs around that long, so,
and is willing to get in a fight.
Oh yeah, and not only that, but crowd the plate. He got like beaned badly like several times. The other again, like, showing my deference to the 1988 Dodgers, Alfredo Griffin. Not only did he hit under 200 with the Dodgers in 1988, he had a broken hand that year, so he didn't qualify for the batting title. In 1990, I looked this up recently. I think he's one of two guys in like the last 60 years or something to like qualify for the batting title and then have a sub 300 slugging and on base. And so, just a terrible hitter, but like, and like, the defensive numbers don't even like give him credit, but like, everyone seemed to love his defense, so like, he was a defense on reputation guy. So like, and obviously I'm partial to 88, so like, whatever, that's fine. But then the only other choice is Kevin Elster. He hit three home runs to open what was then Pac Bell Park in San Francisco, and I think that alone is strong enough to have him on there. Like I said, I'm partial to any of these. I think my 88 bias would lean toward Griffin. But yeah, honestly, I'm fine with any of these three. And like, if you have someone else too, that's fine too.
So, thinking. Yeah, well, yeah. Let's go ahead and give it to Griffin. We deferred away from 88, your 88 bias there. But I have a workaround for this.
Okay.
how about we make Don Zimmer the manager of this team?
Okay. I thought you were going to say third base for a second, but you said
no. I have a third baseman I can't get away from.
Okay, no, that's fine because honestly, like, I'm struggling at third base. So, like, let's do third base next then.
Okay, cool. So third base. We need a Roger Dorn figure, someone who little too rich for their britches, maybe slacking off because of that. And this is not what this player is, but certainly known for making money. So I'm going to make that narrative, even if it's not real. Bobby Bonilla.
Yep. Oh man. Okay. Nice. Yeah. So Bobby Bonilla is on this list. Oh man, he was so bad. Wow.
Negative. Still making money. Still cashing the check.
The Mets. Yeah. So again, the only person I listed at third because I was like, I'll come back to it. Was Jeff Hamilton, and I figured I'm like, I hope Jacob has a third baseman because, like, he was bad. Like, but like, again, 88 bias. He's the only. That's really the only thing keeping him on my list. So
I just the storyline of he comes back somehow in shape and says, "I'm not Mr. July 1st. I am a good baseball player, and I'm going to prove it all wrong."
Also, and also fine with making the major league minimum. Because he's still getting $1 million from the Mets every July. So, like, he's like, I'm good, you know, like,
and, you know, whatever. He made that money for a reason. He, you know, had flashes of greatness. So, like,
right.
let's get him on the team.
My annual rant against the Bobby Bonilla, like, everyone likes to go, ah, ha, ha, stupid Mets. Like, but, like, if you look at it, like, a lot of people, like, don't, I'm going to sound like an asshole here. Like people don't understand the time value of money. I say this as someone who's a terrible saver, and like I don't understand the time value of money, like, in my own actions. But all that was, he had like $6 million or something due to him, and then they just worked it into an annuity. And like if you worked it out, I think the annual percentage rate was 8% over the if you do like a net present value thing. That's not unreasonable. Like it's a like high thing for a team to guarantee, but like that's a reasonable request. It's not like they act like he's stealing from the Mets or like that the Mets are so dumb for doing this. But all it was like it's like trading today's money for tomorrow. And he's like $1 million a year. That sounds fine. Like it's an 8% return. You know, if you invested in something that's a great like long term play, fine. So like that's what he did. And like so it's not as like dumb as people implied.
As I mentioned, I have to kind of fabricate the fact that he's this Roger Dorn figure when I'm sure he's not. I have no proof of that except for the check. But here's my final ploy to the listeners if they're going to fight me on this. And Major League, there's the American Express commercial and how they get more money for traveling and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. How about a J.G. Wentworth commercial starring Bobby Bonilla for our new Dodgers team?
Wait, and then complete with him, like, completely, like, botching the line, like, very wooden-like, and he's like...
I need cash now.
And he snaps, like, off beat or whatever. I love it. I love all of it.
All right, so now we're in outfield, and whew, outfield's tough. I have a large list of names.
Okay, I'm glad, because I am, like... I have some names, but, like, man, honestly, like, I was looking like, eh. Like, none of them stood out to me.
I've got some great ones.
Why don't you list like two first, and then I'll see if I can add two.
Going back to my pick for catcher, Charles Johnson has a cousin named Fred McGriff.
You know what? And I think when we were just spitballing this idea before we figured out,
exactly he was the first name you came up with.
Right. We were like, well, yeah, you have like what? But as first baseman though.
Did he not play any outfield with the Dodgers? I did not check.
No. I don't think he ever played it. So like we could add him to our mix. Well, I'm gonna note him at first base right now, like as one of the three, and we'll come back to him.
Yeah, and we do have a utility spot that we can give.
Right. Exactly. So
how about Korean baseball RBI leader Jerry Sands?
And also timely in that he played in the KBO the last 2 years, and ESPN just made a deal to start televising KBO games. The first game is actually in about 3 hours from now tonight.
Jerry Sands is in under contract in NBB in Japan right
and now. Yes,
but he
but
did
the last,
lead
the last 2 years. Yeah, he was in KBO. Yeah.
So I thought that storyline would be great. The prodigal son comes back having raked in Korea and trying to prove his worth there. And yeah, I have no idea why I thought Fred McGriff played some outfield. I don't know where that came from, but he'll be on utility. Filling the Willie Mays Hayes slot, I'll give you one more name, Roger Cedeno.
I like Cedeno a lot, especially because when I first started playing a PC video game in college, when I had my first computer that was like cost like $2,000 and it weighed like 1,000 pounds, Roger Cedeno stole like hundreds of bases for me in that game. It was like him and Chad Fonville running wild. So I like it. I'm taking these in. I do. Okay. So
I have two more names for you when you're ready, but go ahead and throw some out yourself.
Okay. So a couple, now Mickey Hatcher is a name I listed. I'm not that married to, obviously he was a World Series hero in 88. Again, he played first and left that year. He barely played like in the regular season. He was a multiple stint Dodger. He would qualify in the outfield. I'm just listing him as a name. The one name that I'm like, I would love to have on this team is Eric Davis.
Okay. Make your case.
Because of the promise like that he had, like he and Strawberry were both from Los Angeles, both like came home and I wish I still had it. It's the poster of Triple Threat. The outfield of Eric Davis, Brett Butler, and Daryl Strawberry heading into 1992 season. Outside of Butler, they all sucked, and the Dodgers lost 99 games that year. It was just a crushing disappointment. But also, he was dealing with injuries, and then he actually rebounded later, and he even overcame cancer after that. And like Eric Davis in his prime is like one of the best baseball players I've ever seen, and just natural athlete, like the. Maybe the best power speed combo in the history of the game. I know that sounds might be blasphemous, like because Willie Mays is probably better, but like he was crazy in the 80s. Like he literally has a well, I believe still he. I think he's the only guy, unless Bonds did it. He had a year that he had 37 home runs and 50 RBIs or 50 steals.
Ooh,
yeah. But also my favorite year of him, so like he was nuts. I'm looking the year. Okay, Bonds did it too. Bonds had 33-52 in 1990, but yeah, Eric Davis was crazy. He my favorite Eric Davis stat. I forget the exact dates, but it was sometime from July to 86 to July 87 in a 162 game stretch. He hit 48 home runs and stole 96 bases. He had a 27 home run, 80 steal year. Like, just insane numbers. Like, he was obviously hurt all the time. So I think there's, like, he's sort of someone to root for. So, like, of all these guys, I would fight for him the most. But, like, Yeah.
So I have two more names, one of which I think we should – it was actually, I think, the first name I came up with to possibly make this list as a sort of reconstruction project. Andrew Jones.
Oh man, so he's on here, huh?
Uh-huh. Yeah, of course he is. Another second pager because we were about to record, and I'm like, I know Andrew. I looked it up. Andrew Jones is on there. Why isn't on this list? And he is also a second pager.
Yeah. So yeah, you're right.
And he was bad. Speaking of bad,
just completely terrible.
But prior to that, you know, like Hall of Fame worthy player.
Yeah, I like where this is going. I have two more names and
I've held back my strongest name.
Oh yeah, so we're fine. But I just want to say, so the one that's like stood out that I know nothing about. So this is more an acknowledgement more than anything, and it's maybe not necessarily my endorsement of him, but Cal Abrams.
Okay.
1949 to 1952. So he played on the Boys of Summer teams, but like he was a part timer. Barely played. He had a 387 on base percentage, almost no power, but like that's the third highest on base percentage of anyone in this group. I just wanted to note that. Mm-hmm. The guy that I would kill for and like sort of like half-heartedly is Mike Kincaid. He got so we think like Justin Turner and like on the former Dodger minor leaguer and then and major leaguer and then current Diamondback Tim LoCastro gets hit a lot. Mike Kincaid in his Dodger career, parts of two seasons, 2002-2003, 251 plate appearances, 22 hit by pitches. So I like he is probably our Dorn. Out, you know, outside of like the star factor and possible future owner factor. But yeah, I like his ability to get hit by a pitch. So if we have a spot, I'd like to consider him for it. But I think that we've listed enough names here that he's not going to make our outfield.
All right. Now, the hitter that I'm going to make the strongest case for. Yep. What if I told you we can get a player on here that is a Hall of Famer? Yep. Played 16 years in LA and is in the same group for a good thing as Pete Rose, Ty Cobb, Julio Franco, Hank Aaron, Derek Jeter, Ichiro Suzuki, and Stan Musial.
Look, you don't have to sell me any more than saying, you know, Julio Franco. So, like, and I'm actually intrigued on who this is going to be because it didn't pop out. And so I have no idea. Who are we talking here?
Jigger Stats.
Oh, classic. So I don't remember what this was from. So I think when the Dodgers had the 100th anniversary in 1990, they officially recognized 1890 as their starting year, even though they started in 1884. That's when they joined the National League. But there was some they had a lot of programming, and like it was on like an alternate station. It wasn't necessarily on the KTTV back then. I remember it being on like one of our sort of other stations, but they had like a weekend or something where they had all sorts of cool like videos and stuff. And I remember there's one of them, and I just have it in my head of like Vin Scully saying the name Jigger Stats, and I didn't really know much about him, but like that's such a great name.
Too. Well, yeah. And also, it's just an incredible name.
Also, if we flash back to our old spring training record days, it's Stats with a Z.
Yeah.
So it's like our good friends at the sports bar in Arizona. So wow.
So to explain my preamble a little bit before people get really confused, because
why 16 years?
I was gonna explain. I was very careful with my wording. If you notice, he's a Hall of Famer in the Pacific Coast League, so he's not a major league ball Hall of Famer. He played 16 years in LA for the Los Angeles Angels in the Pacific Coast League, and he has 4,000 hits if you count minors and majors, and if we're also counting NPB as either a major or a minor league, the players I listed alongside him are the only 8 players to have amassed 4,000 hits.
Like I think that's probably enough to like at least make him the third outfielder for me. So like I'm willing to just put him in for sure, and I think we should
argue
we
have about enough the other
here
two?
To figure out. So like I think of the ones you named, I think, do you think it would be fair, do you think, like, just having playing on the talent upside, and obviously not what they did with the Dodgers, but if we just went Andrew and Eric Davis, or are you super married to, like, Cedeno and Sands?
I'm fine with that, and we still have a utility spot, and I only have one more name to throw into the mix there.
Okay, so I'm just noting for now, so our outfield tentatively is Andrew Jones, Eric Davis, and Jigger Stats. That's fun to say. Okay.
So do you have anyone else? So we have the outfielders, we have the first base dilemma, and I have one more name that I wanted to throw into the utility role. Do you have any more you wanted to throw in?
I have two people listed. Trent Hubbard. And I remember him when he was playing as Trinidad Hubbard. And I think they changed that later. But I'm not holding that against him or anything. I'm just noting. But of this group, I keep forgetting about those second pagers. Oh, yeah. Okay. So there's a player named Eddie Wilson who was mostly who was an outfielder in the 30s. He has an 844 OPS. That's the highest of this group. Trent Hubbard has the second highest. 799. They both played in high offensive eras, but 98-99 are the Dodgers. 799, Trent Hubbard played center field, left field, right field, catcher, although that was very briefly, and then second base and third base. So I like him at utility, but, like, again, it's Trent Hubbard. Like, I'm not going to, like, fight if we don't want to have – the only other person I listed was Jose Gonzalez. It's an 88 thing. Also, he last week, if you remember, he scored the winning run as a pinch runner in the first game I can remember going to at Dodger Stadium. That would be his role on this team. He would probably never bat. He'd be our pinch runner. I don't know if we can afford doing that if we have a 15-man team. But, like, those are, like, the only two names I really have. But I think some of the other options are, like, especially with our first base logjam, I think we should probably use it here.
So I think the people we have jammed up are probably more worthy. But I did want to mention one more player from my era that I think at least deserves consideration, is Hesop Choi.
Oh, man. And, again, forgot he was on this list. Yeah.
Fan favorite had while with the Dodgers had a big comeback story, where he was again unfairly tied to an unpopular trade, and then I don't remember if you remember his coming out party. It wasn't in 2005; it was in 2004, where he drew a walk in the Steve Finley game, and the fans just go
crazy,
crazy, where the Hesop Choi chant really kind of came into its own.
And he had the three homer game. He had like six home runs in three games.
Yeah, and I went to the game, the middle, it was against the Twins, and I was at the middle game where he hit the longest home run he hit in that span. He had a really well-known grand slam, another game I was at. So I have a deep personal connection to Hesop Choi. Also, just a very good baseball player. I just never quite put it together while in the majors. Had a very successful KBO career before and after. So definitely someone I think that, given enough managerial support, could be an extremely effective hitter.
Yeah, so I'm willing to, like, forego Stubbs and just leave him off. So I think now if we make first base, let's make first base McGriff.
Okay.
And then so utility comes down to High Pockets Kelly and Hesop Choi.
Oh no, you can't make me pick.
Right? Like, so this is a tough spot. So
we probably could have two bench rolls
if we want to stretch it. Let's see what we got. So okay, I like this though because it's a righty versus a lefty. So let's just look at the team. So let's see, Bill Bergen. It doesn't say on here. Dang it. Okay. It's harder to look up than I can't imagine. Who was a left-handed hitting catcher back then? Okay, so Bill. First of all, Bill Bergen. We're gonna always pinch hit for him, but he's right-handed. We actually can't pinch hit for Bill Bergen because we don't have another catcher. But so let's see. Bobby Valentine. He's right-handed. Bonilla was a switch hitter, so that gives us some. Flexibility. McGriff, obviously left-handed. Alfredo Griffin, he was a switch hitter, but obviously terrible. Andrew and Eric Davis are right-handed. Our good friend Jigger Stats, one of the great names. He's a right-handed. I think we need a lefty here.
All right.
If McGriff is our guy, I think we go Hesop Choi here.
Okay. I will. We'll throw this will be the hitter question to Twitter users. Amongst those three first basemen, which two make the team?
McGriff, Choi, and High Pockets Kelly.
Yep.
Okay.
So, listeners, let us know who you think gets the nod here.
Yeah. So now we just have to figure out the pitching staff.
So this has been so much fun. We're gonna do a little commercial and then we'll come back.
Before we do the commercial, I have to send you into the commercial.
With a trivia question. All right.
Okay. So as you noticed, I was trying to cram as many 1988 players as I could on here, and also because there's a lot of them on this list,
which is really funny, right? This is Ballyhoo, right. Great team that the current Dodger teams, which are arguably just much better, are trying to chase the glory of the 88 team, and just how many bad players were on this team.
Now, my trivia question is, and I will tell you this, I was kind of shocked by this answer. I don't know about shocked, but like I was like, okay, so surprising. But I'll say the trivia is, how many postseason starts did players on either of these lists, pitchers or position player, pitchers and position players, how many postseason starts did they make for the Dodgers in 1988?
All right, we'll be back after this. I do like these number trivia questions because I can just throw out a stupid guess.
Yep.
So this, to be clear, this is not the number of players who made a postseason start. It's the number of starts accumulated.
Number of total starts in 1988 by these players.
All right, so let's see. I'm trying to remember like how many games total the playoffs went to. And
the Dodgers, I'll tell you this, the Dodgers played 12 games.
Okay, that's
seven in the NLCS, five in the World Series.
I got there correctly. That makes me, I should give credit. Come on. So
you get a half a point. Although we've never scored this. So like,
so it's 12 times 9, 108 is the total number that it could be.
But then you remember Oral Hershiser had more than one war. So like, you start subtracting out, yeah.
67.
I shouldn't have said something because you overshot it, like, and it makes the real answer like look puny. But I'll say it's 45.
No, that's still the same ballpark. We're good.
So like, but there are 8 players on this list.
I know.
Actually, I'm sorry. Not 9. Oh wait. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 10 players on this list played for the 1988 Dodgers. Ken Howell, the pitcher, did not play in the playoffs. Chris Gwynn didn't play in the playoffs. I believe that was his rookie year. 2 players didn't start. The aforementioned Jose Gonzalez. He played in 9 of the 12 games, though, mostly as a pinch runner and pinch hitter and defensive replacement. In the outfield, Tracy Woodson played in 7 games, never started. Going back from the lowest amount of starts, Danny Heap started once. He started DH in Game 4 of the World Series in Oakland. He played in 6 games. Mike Davis, a ballyhooed free agent signing that year, who averaged like over 20 home runs a season the previous 3 years with Oakland. He hit 2 home runs and hit like 187 with the Dodgers, but he had the famous walk, so all is forgiven. He started 3 times, all in Oakland in the World Series. He played in 8 games. Franklin Stubbs, who I was trying to jam in at first base, he made 6 starts. He started game 1 of the NLCS and then never again in that series. And then he started all 5 games of the World Series. He played in 9 games. Mickey Hatcher, who took over for Stubbs at first base in the NLCS and then moved to the outfield when Kirk Gibson couldn't play in the World Series, he started 11 times. And then the 2 players who made 12 starts, Alfredo Griffin, who again, we got in it short, and Jeff Hamilton, who started not only all 12 games, he played every inning that postseason. So yeah, that's a prolific team. It's crazy. But before we move on to the pitchers, I just wanted to say, I was just looking over this list, so just a couple names that I think we have to mention. Glenn Burke, originator of the high five, is on here. And then let's see. So you like Elion Herrera, another like classic like unheralded utility guy in recent years. Mark Loretta had a walk-off single in the 2009 playoffs. Jeremy Bernitz, who I seem to always forget was a Dodger briefly. and like yeah, just there's a ton of players like
Jason Phillips.
I kind of love it. Yeah. Oh, I think he was one of the ones we were mentioning last week because I was trying to make the case that he needed to be on the team because of the goggles. Like,
yeah.
But yeah, ultimately, I think Bill Bergen is a better choice. But yeah, so I like where we're at so far. Now let's hit up the pitching.
Okay. So do you want to let's start with starters. That makes sense, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So do you want to start us off?
Yep. The one name that leapt off the page to me, is Kazuhisa Ishii. He was a very ballyhooed signing with the Dodgers, and like he started off really well. I think he won like his first 6 starts, if I'm not mistaken. I didn't look this up, so don't quote me. But then he just he was walking guys, and then like he just sort of fell off the cliff, and just sort of like he pitched for them for 3 years, and he wasn't like I guess he probably wasn't like terrible, but he walked so many. He was pretty bad. But like I like his winning percentage is .590. He won 36 games in 3 years. Obviously, you know, you don't measure pitchers like that. A 93 ERA plus, very serviceable. He has the third most wins on the list.
I just remember he was always the starting pitching when I went in that early aughts era. He was always good. He was the starter in the Milton Bradley water bottle game, a game I went to. So I have very fond memories of him. Yeah, I remember, and again, this was so young into my really following Dodgers career. I remember him being way better, probably because he was in so many starts that I fondly remember.
One of the first spring trainings I ever went to, and this was probably 6 or 7 years after he left the team. I saw like a random fan in a number 17 Kazuhisa Ishii jersey. And I was like, how did you ever buy this? Like, but yeah, so he has the fourth most innings on this group, 473, 86 starts, also third. So like he's sort of the one that jumped out on the page. I just wanted to mention first, but I'm sure we'll be like debating it. So go ahead and name a couple if you want.
So I'm going to save one for a little bit later because it involves me reading. It's almost going to be a Dodgers rewind. I've got a Sabre biography project story to go with it. How about another sort of a recent Dodger, Dan Herron?
He is on my list as a secondary choice. But like there's a lot of guys around him who are like in that same vein. I like everything about him post-retirement. Pretty active on Twitter, very funny.
Sort of embraces his role, which I think fits in the mode of major leagues as a pitcher who's losing some velocity and trying to make it work.
Also, yeah, also has the quirkiness of like famously like never eating fish or never even like trying it. It's not a tough sell to add him to my list. So yeah, that's a solid pick.
You give me one more, and then I'm going to do my story.
Okay. So the other one I wanted to add, and he wasn't necessarily that good, Alan Foster.
Okay.
He pitched for the Dodgers in, the late 60s to 1970. He was a pretty ballyhooed prospect. He just didn't really work out. He 88 ERA plus in his time there, so wasn't terrible. And actually, he pitched mostly in relief. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Mostly starting. I looked at the wrong column. But the reason I have him on this list, he was the one who gave up the Willie Stargell home run that went out of the stadium.
Mm.
Or the first, I think the first one. So that's why he's on my list. So, like, I think I envision in a major league scenario where he's, like, walking into camp and everyone's like, hey, isn't that the guy who gave up? And then, like, that's sort of his story, like, in the thing. So, like, yeah, that's why I have him on my list.
All right. So I actually have two players that require a little bit of stories to explain.
That's both, what podcasts are for.
Absolutely. So here we go. This is from the Sabre Biography Project. The first person I have, let's see if I can get his real name in here, Walter William Beck. He has a much more known for a nickname, which I'm going to explain here. Let's see. This is in regards to the 1934 season getting started. To compensate for his loss of velocity and trouble pitching at left-handed hitters, Beck attempted to develop a knuckleball. It did not work. He was regularly pounded by the opposition, and even on the few occasions when he did pitch well, he was smacked around by left-handed hitters. A little bit later in this biography, the season started well for Elmer the Great. One of his nicknames, but not the one that stuck. Though his first start ended in a tie, which won a tie, he held Boston to a single run through seven innings. However, the next 6 weeks did not go as well. He lost four times, gave up over 12 earned runs per game, and only once did he survive as many as four innings. Assessing Beck in early July, Tommy Holmes, Brooklyn Eagle writer Tommy Holmes Limited, Beck's performances have been worse than anybody thought they could be. In early June, Beck was demoted to the bullpen, but in the bullpen, he through six appearances, he only gave up six runs in 14 innings. And as a reward, Stengel decided to give Beck a start in the second game of the July 4th doubleheader against Philadelphia. It would become a fateful decision. Beck's first start in more than a month didn't last long. Facing only eight Phillies, he gave up three hits, walked three, and allowed three runs in only two-thirds of an inning. Stengel had seen enough. Anticipating Beck's reaction, Stengel remained in the dugout and instead instructed his catcher, Al Lopez, to inform Beck that his afternoon was over. Meanwhile, from the dugout, Stengel waved in a relief pitcher. What week is that, by the way? Just, was that more common? Do you know? The manager just changing a pitcher without even leaving the dugout, making the catcher do it.
That's a good question.
I'm curious.
They had more player managers back then, so it's a little different, but like,
that's fair.
That's, I don't know. Like, I'll say this, Al Lopez did end up being a manager, so maybe he had like.
Al Lopez appears later in in one of my players' lists. So
nice.
So as expected, Beck was furious. Rather than handing the ball to Lopez, and now this is a quote, I'm not sure from where, Beck threw perhaps the best fastball he has thrown this season up against the right field fence. The ball hit the tin facade with a thunderous boom. Meanwhile, several feet away, right fielder Hack Wilson was dozing with his back to the field. When he heard the boom off the wall, Wilson instinctively rushed to retrieve the ball, turned and fired a perfect strike to second. The crowd howled at the sequence. Soon after, an amused reporter labeled Beck Boom Boom. And for the rest of his life, Elmer the Great was known as Boom Boom Beck.
Elmer the Great is so good. So
Boom Boom Beck is one I lift up.
I like that, everything about that story. He's like, so like old timey Trevor Bauer, maybe without like the harassment online. But I like the fact that too, that we went through the entire offensive list and never once brought up Wilson Bedement, which was like surprising. We could have had a team with two boom booms on it. So he is, I'm penciling him in. I'm just noting, cause that's a great story. I like it. So I'm just tentatively putting him as one of our starting pitchers. So I like it.
Do you have another name? Because I have another big story to do.
So since your guy is Elmer the Great, I will note that one of the names they listed on here was Elmer Descends. A classic.
Loved
like
him.
Overperforming, like multiple role guy. He only started eight games with the Dodgers, but
He and Almedo Saenz were just kind of like tied in my memory as like,
yeah,
the same kind of like just like overachieving is the right word.
Yeah. And would do like just about any role. He had a 113 ERA plus, like that is tied for eighth on this list. He pitched 108 innings. So of all the guys with over 100 innings, the best ERA plus on the list. So like that counts for something. Maybe he doesn't make the staff, but I just thought it was fitting that I did list him. And since you had your boom boom was Elmer the Great, I just thought Elmer Descends would be a nice little mate for him.
All right, here we go. This is, I think, mm-hmm. the best name on either list. You know where I'm going?
Okay. Honestly, I don't, but like, I just love the fact that we've already gotten Jigger Stats and Boom Boom Beck. And there's someone who with a better name. So,
Frederick Mitchell Walker, but as he was known, Mysterious Walker.
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah. Okay, I like it.
So, kind of known as a multi-athlete at University of Chicago, played for the Superbas, which later became the Dodgers, also played in a federal league team, the Brooklyn Tip Tops, and in my mind, in our time machine, we're picking him up right after his last Tip Tops game.
Yeah.
So he'll be wearing his Tip Tops uniform throughout this endeavor, mostly by name alone. But I think also his Wikipedia picture is extremely eerie. But I want Mysterious Walker, who was I think on this list six in. Walk percentage, by the way, so fitting for Mysterious Walker.
Also, same amount of walks as strikeouts, 35 and 35 in 1913. So, I like it.
So I'm going to read this just a little blip from a local reporter. I forgot exactly where I got this. The big feature of this doubleheader was the work of the Iron Busher, who heaved in both games. In the first of 10 innings, he allowed but 7 hits. And then the second of 7 innings, 6 swats were made of him. Hash Mitchell, the mystery that came from nowhere to pitch 4 straight victories for the Seals. Everyone watched Mitchell in the hope that they might guess who he was looking at him. And while they were gazing, they saw some real spitball pitching that was remarkable for the amount of juice he used to deceive the local batsmen. In general, just old-timey baseball reporting. Always a joy. So
it's so good. And some of those old headlines are great, too. There's only 2 other names that I'm like, well, okay, I'm just going to mention these. And these aren't the 2 that I was, but I just want to throw them out here in the same sort of Dan Heron vein. Brandon McCarthy and Brett Anderson. like kind of both in their own way. Like, you know, I guess I don't want to call the A's the California Penal League, but maybe that they're like, they both come from there, like, you know, indirectly or whatever. But okay. So the
I
other
have,
two, yeah, go ahead.
I have one other that can kind of slot into either starter or reliever, and then I'm out of names. I have a few more reliever names if you want them, but I figured we kind of have enough at this point. But
the,
I have
the main. Oh, go ahead.
No, you go first.
The main starter I wanted to add to the list was Carlos Perez.
Okay.
And mostly because of the ferocity with which he attacked a Gatorade jug. And that we've all seen the clip, just going to town on it. So like he's there for me. The other name was like that. This was sort of a half-hearted, addition. Dave Goltz, one of the 2 ill-fated free agent signings of 1980 with Don Stanhouse. Both were terrible with the Dodgers. And like it basically like scared them off free agency for until like the winter of 87-88, and like that was just a thing you could do back then because baseball was so weird. Like they're like, no, we're not doing free agency. Like that's a thing. That's a thing that teams could choose. So like, those are like the main names. Who else you got?
P. Ridge Day. Another entry in my great
names. Best names on this.
So P. Ridge Day. So a lot of these, I pick the name. I'm like, aha, that's a funny name, but there's no other reason other than the name to go for them. And each time I was overwhelmed with how much of a character they were, which makes sense if you're going to earn a nickname. So P. Ridge Day, just to give you an idea, his first sentence on his Wikipedia page is, Henry Clyde Day, also known as P. Ridge Day, was a champion Arkansas hog collar and right-handed pitcher.
That's the first thing is hog collar.
Yeah. So Al Lopez, hey, who's back, recounted a story about a 1931 exhibition game against the New York Yankees. The fans have been reading up about him being a champion hog collar, so they all started calling, yip, yip, yee. He strikes out the first hitter, puts the ball and glove down, and lets out this call. He strikes out the next batter and does it again. Babe Ruth was on deck, and he gets a kick out of it. He's laughing at this guy. Then he has Roof with 2 strikes. He gets real quiet. The fans are hoping he'll strike out Roof so he can yell again. On the 3rd pitch, Roof hits one over a mile over the fence. Henry Clyde Day never did his hog call again.
I love it. Okay, I think we have enough for a staff here.
Obviously. Oh, we do. No, we had to kind of throw him out there. So let's figure this
now,
out.
So I think. Like I'm enthralled enough that Boom Boom Beck and Mysterious Walker like have to go in. I think I like to fight for Kaz Ishii. So if those are 3, like I'd be okay with having like Dan Heron as the other guy. Are you married to any of the other ones over him, or like would you is a staff of Ishii, Boom Boom, Dan Heron, and Mysterious Walker like enough?
Just a I don't know. Because I have definitely 3 in the dead ball ish era with really colorful histories, and picking
so,
only 2 of the 3 is tough.
Right, but also probably more, or I don't know, fair is the right word, but like just like balancing it out a little.
Oh no, I like, completely agree. We should only be picking 2. So readers, read up on P. Ridge Day, Mysterious Walker, and Boom Boom Beck, and you tell me which of those two you want to make this team. If I had to pick, I would go with Peerage Day and Mysterious Walker, but the Boom Boom Beck story is maybe enough to pencil me in.
So we're really down to just one more reliever.
And to be noted, Peerage Day was mostly a reliever if we wanted to go there, but I have a laundry. I have three names to add into the reliever list.
So there are two names I will fight for on the reliever list for the one spot. So I would just want to note I wrote down as people the list Bobby Castillo. I wrote down Brandon League just because of the comedy factor of somehow he started like a lot of spring trainings like ahead of Kenley Jansen on the depth chart at closer until like it wasn't. But the two names I mentioned one before, Ken Howell did not pitch in the 88 playoffs, but he has, the most saves of anybody on this list with 31. Again, it's an 88 bias thing. I'm not that married to him, but like he's one of the two. I think my other like sort of really want him on is Yency Brazoran.
Yeah, he's on my list.
if only because in the old Dodger Thoughts days, his nickname, and there was a shirt that said
game over.
With a GHAME. And I don't know about you. Isn't that just enough to have him on? especially with Joe Kelly. Now that's a volatile pen and like perfectly like fitting with this team. So, but
the only other name I had, and I Joe Kelly and Yency Brazoran was my relief, was my pen and never really altered. Peerage Day, I had as a starter. Brian Wilson is the only other name I wanted to throw into there. It seems kind of fitting, but at the same time, it's really hard to put him over Joe Kelly and Yency Brazoran.
Yeah, you're right. So the other name that I like was actually really good and like probably underrated was Luis Avilon.
Mm-hmm.
Like his like strikeout rate was excellent, and he was generally really good at getting lefties out. But like, you know, if we're making a real pen, sure. But like, if we're just picking two guys on like a sort of a comical team, then no. But yeah, so I think we have our team. I'll put in the notes about the like sort of 3-for-2 stuff with.
Yeah, we have McGriff, two ties. I think that's great. We're great to hear back on how we break these ties.
Yeah. So yeah, that's our team, everybody. I like it.
That's a great team, I think.
I mean, I would watch that movie. Like, no question.
So now, do you want to break from Dodgers Rewind? I know you have one getting to go, but we are a little over. Up to you.
I'll just mention him because he's on this list. The reason I was looking through old baseball cards and I'm like, he has to be on this 0-1 WAR list. And it's Rafael Bornegal, who was drafted by the Dodgers in 1992 out of Florida State in the 19th round. He made his debut in 92. He played for parts of three seasons. He had negative WAR. He was a defensive shortstop. I forgot this in 94. The Dodgers sent Jose Offerman down after like two and a half full seasons in the majors. They were like, he was not hitting at all. And they brought up Bornegal to start like the rest of the season. He started the last 40 games before the strike hit. I'll just note this from the LA Times. Bill Russell, then a coach, said even though he hit at Albuquerque, and Bornegal did, he hit .332. He never really hit otherwise. We didn't bring Bornegal here for his bat. He can go get the ball with the best of them. But then if you look at it, total zone rating on Baseball Reference, his numbers were almost as bad as Offerman's defensively. But Offerman led the majors in errors for like two straight years. So he had the rep. But the one thing I'll note, just so I can ask you a trivia question, Bornegal in the minors hit one home run before he was called up to the majors in 525 games, almost 2,000 plate appearances. With the Dodgers, he hit zero home runs in 58 games and 172 plate appearances. That is the 93rd most plate appearances with zero home runs in the franchise. Can you name the Dodger with zero home runs and the most plate appearances?
No, can I not?
Yeah. So I will say this.
Is he on our list?
Ooh, no.
Oh, then probably not.
Because the actual answer is a Hall of Famer. I'll give you three answers because these are all unique in their own right. Don Sutton.
I almost asked you have been going on a streak of discluding pitchers from hitting questions like this, so I think I had that locked in my mind. I might have been able to get there.
Hershiser is 6/798. He never hit a home run with the Dodgers. Johnny Cooney was an outfielder in the 30s and 40s, 1,075 plate appearances. He had zero. Jamie Carroll was the most recent example. Two full years, 924 plate appearances, no home runs. But he was actually productive in those 2 years. So, like, interesting. But, yeah, I just thought that was fun. That's our trivia for that.
Well, it's time to end the show with...
Questions from Craig. We love them.
Five-ish questions from Craig. We're skipping one, and we'll explain why when we get there. But the first question we're not skipping. The first thing I ever stood in line to see was the premiere of The Empire Strikes Back in 1980. I recall my friends and I stood in two lines, the first to buy the tickets and then the second to get in, probably the 10 p.m. show at the old Avco Theater. I wanted to know what do you remember as the first concert, movie, or anything else you stood in line to see?
Do you have one that comes to mind?
I have a very vague memory of staying in line, and another example of my parents having to fill in details. By the way, my mom has sent me proof. There was two games, a Kings game and a Dodgers game, that we weren't sure when they were. My mom clued me in, if you're curious. I'll tweet about it. Being in line at the El Capitan, it was the first movie release. Here's a trivia question for you, Eric. Disney bought the El Capitan Theater, I believe, in 1991 or two. Do you know the first movie played at the El Capitan after Disney bought it?
Trying to think of the timing of it.
I'll give you a hint. You don't. It's not animated, if that's any...
I wasn't going to choose animated. I thought about it, but is it Mrs. Doubtfire?
It is not. It was 1981. I just checked. The reopening was in 91, I should say. I think they bought it a little earlier than that.
Yeah.
The movie was The Rocketeer. So I don't know, like, if it was... I doubt it was the premiere at the El Capitan, but it had to have been fairly early on, because I remember there was definitely a line, and I got pulled out by a film crew. I was five at the time, and I got pulled out by
like a
PSA. Like, they were interviewing me for a PSA, and the question I remember very specifically, it was, do you think drinking is good? And I'm a five-year-old, so I don't know, and my parents both don't drink very much at all. I think drinking is drinking water, not drinking alcohol. So I say, yeah, sure, I love drinking. And they were... I didn't understand what
you would have been a meme today. That would have been, how great would that have been?
So if that counts, that's it. Yeah, that's my pick.
I like it. So I'm having trouble coming at this. I'm a person, I hate, like, waiting in line for anything, like anything. Even if there's like a long line at the drive-thru in and out, I'll just come back, you know. But like, probably growing up, went to more movies with lines. So I will say this. The thing that's funny about this is, just generally, like in the 80s, to get tickets to like concerts and even some sporting events, one of the main ways to go was like to Sears and like May Company. And they had like, it was like Ticketron and Ticketmaster back then. And like, so that was a thing where you would actually wait in line, and you like, especially for like concerts. I didn't go to concerts as a kid, but my brothers did. And I just remember like, that was a major thing. The one thing that I can sort of remember, like, that was like an event movie that I went to, and I was probably way too young for this. I was like 8 or 9 when Jaws 3D came out. And I'm certain I went with like my it was at my dad's, and I think it was one of like my stepsister, I think, who have like I've not like caught up with, and or maybe I don't know if it was stepsister, honestly I can't remember who I went with, but I'm just trying to think of this, like, there had to be a line for that, because it was a huge thing. It was also in 3D, where we had the old, like, paper 3D glasses. And but that was a gruesome movie, and it did not sit well with me, like, just nightmare wise. But yeah, I think I'm waited in line for that. But other than that, I can't really think of many things I've waited in line for.
The second question is a Simpsons question, and he's essentially asking us to draft best episodes, which you and I have already come up with as a show idea. So we're going to shelve that question because, you know, this thing's not going anywhere for a while. We're going to have more stuff to talk about. You and I both lover The Simpsons. Might have a guest or two that we'll bring in for that episode. Still thinking about that. So sometime soon, you and I will do the great big Simpsons episode draft. And we'll answer that question then.
Nice.
The lowest total for a hits leader for a decade since 1900 was 1,578 hits by, how do I say this?
Lou Boudreau,
from 1940 to 1949. The second lowest total was 1,695 hits by Robinson Cano in the last 10 seasons. Do you think the leading total for this upcoming decade will be higher than both of those totals?
So I was looking at this, and, like, it's hard to, like, get hits on. Ozzy
it's
Albies
really hard
dead.
To get hits when baseball is shut
when
down.
When there's no games, right? Yeah. It just in a normal situation, Ozzy Albies led the majors last year with 189 hits. That's a low total to, like, lead the majors. He's only 23 this year. He's averaged 178 hits the last 2 years. Francisco Lindor averaged 178 over the last four. He's a volume hit guy. He's 26. So, like, even if they put up that for 10 years, you know, that's obviously 1780. I think you're hard-pressed. Obviously, we're losing probably a half a season in 2020. Plus, people get hurt. You can't really project for 10 years or whatever. I think, that said, I think the total will be somewhere in between those two numbers, given this sort of weird season. Truncated season, but I think there's enough young talent that might do it. Like, Ronald Acuna had 175 hits last year in his first full year. He's only 22. He could be a volume guy. So I think in a normal time, you might see someone get like 1700 or more, but, like, if you just lop off that half a season, that's what makes it difficult. So yeah, I would say somewhere in between those two numbers.
How many plate appearances and innings pitched this year would make a batting title and ERA champion legitimate in your eyes? Bill Matlock had 320 plate appearances in 1981 when he led the NL with a 341 average. Nolan Ryan pitched 149 innings in the 110 games played by the Astros that year. Ryan led the NL with a 169 ERA. Of course, Fernando had 192 innings pitched and 25 game pitched all starts that year. Valenzuela would finish with a 2.48 ERA and his Cy Young and Rookie of the Year afterwards. So the ultimate question here is, how short or long of a season does that barrier kind of get crossed for you?
So, like, I think we talked about this before in terms of, like, legitimacy of a season, and it probably has to be at least half of a season, like 81 games. But honestly, like, the limits are generally fine, because they're also tied to the games played. So it's not like everyone's under the same sort of, rubric or whatever. So, like, with batting, it's 3.1 plate appearances per team game. Over 162, that's 502 plate appearances. And obviously it's less. If there's 100 games, it's 310 plate appearances. So that's pretty low. But I'm generally okay with that. Like,
I think it really does depend on, like, and when just ranking on how someone did this season and worthy of accolades, yeah. I think it's a fairly low threshold. Where you run a little dangerous is, does someone hit 400? And at that point, right. You're like, or anytime you sort of the asterisks come out is when it becomes an all time, when you start ranking that season against other seasons. As long as you're internal within the season, or just in general of, how can we think this person is sort of as a quality player? I have no problem it being kind of lower than that.
Yeah, and the only other thing I'll say about pitching, because that's an inning per team game to qualify, there's some – Sam Miller a few years back wrote, I think, for Baseball Prospectus about how we should probably lower the threshold for ERA, qualifying for the ERA title, because baseball itself doesn't ask as much of its starters these days. Either, you know, pitching less deep into games, pitching less often, taking some breaks throughout the season, I guess, in the case of the Dodgers, who seem to, you know, utilize that the injured list for rest, things like that. So I'll just point this out. So last year, 62 pitchers in the majors qualified for the ERA title. 76 pitchers had 150 innings, and 89 had 140. If you just look back 5 years ago, 2014, 89 pitchers qualified for the – that's the same number of pitchers that had 140 innings last year. In 2009, 79 batters qualified for the ERA title. That's the same number that had 150. So I think in a general sense, if you lowered the requirement to like 150 innings in a normal season and then just obviously adjust it for, you know, like a truncated season, I would be okay with that going forward. But just generally how it stands inning per game, as long as everybody gets under the same sort of thing, that's generally fine with me.
A quick throwback for the last question. You know who would fit really well in this era?
Yeah.
Mysterious Walker. I have another quote for you. Mysterious Walker, Fred Walker, also known as Mysterious Mitchell, who is pitching for Brooklyn, appears to be a perfectly good top-notcher for about four innings. After that, well, he hasn't won any laurels as a stayer.
My God. That, well, A, that's just great writing. And B, he is perfect. He'd be like, he's a 2020 Dodger, in my opinion.
Here we go.
Like,
Mysterious yeah. Walker. We need to bring back phrases like top notcher and stayer.
Yeah. I love it.
Final question. It's warming up now. If you were to buy a pint of your favorite ice cream right now, would it be something classic like vanilla, chocolate, or strawberry? A swirl of something like caramel or praline and vanilla? Or maybe something with chunks of cookie dough?
So I was thinking about this the other day. I make running lists on my notes app and my phone. For groceries, or like if I'm planning meals, because no matter where I am, I usually have my phone and I'll just jot something down like, oh, just remember to get this at the store. And then by the time I go, and since I've been going to the store every like 2 weeks or so, like it ends up being a pretty big list. But the last like week or so, I've been really craving ice cream. And so I'm going to go to the store later this week and I'm going to be very mad if I forget to buy it. But I'm gonna get mint chip for certain. The other kind that I would consider would be strawberry. But yeah, mint chip is the one for me, and that's the one I'm thinking about, and I can't stop thinking about it. So yeah, so hopefully by the time you listen to this, I'll be eating mint chip ice cream.
Depends on what Craig's going for here. I love a really, really good vanilla. Sweet Rose Creamery in Los Angeles, Santa Monica, has an incredibly good vanilla. But if it's just a vanilla, I'll usually pass on it. If I'm at like a more artisanal ice cream shop, I actually usually look for what sorbets they have. And if they have either a lemon, a lime, or a berry sorbet, that will often be my pick. But if I'm going for a pint that I can get easily in an ice cream out here in Kansas at a grocery store, I'm just going to go with half-baked from Ben & Jerry's.
I like it. I was considering, if I'm going at a grocery store, I might, instead of getting the maybe the store brand, if I'm getting strawberry, I would like to get the whatever the kind is that they have like chunks of strawberry in it. That's also good. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to note also, in addition to ice cream, I have on my list popsicles, and specifically the sugar-free tropical fruit kind. I like that flavor the best. So yeah, I got a sweet tooth right now and it's all I can think about.
Well, go get you some ice cream. I had cookies and milk during our breaks today, so I don't need it. I am satiated there. Listeners, give us feedback on our major league team. This was probably the most fun I had preparing for an episode in a long time. So
this was a lot of fun. Yeah, I think we have a really solid team. I think I would watch this movie for sure. Listeners, help us break the tie in a couple of these spots, but we have a pretty solid team as it is. And while we're thinking about this team, we will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening, everybody.